Welcome to The Downtime Project, where we learn from the internet's most notable outages. I'm Tom Kleinbeter, and with me is Jamie Turner.
Hi.
Before we begin, I just want to remind our listeners that these incidents are really stressful, and we peel them apart to learn, not to judge. Ultimately, Jamie and I have made, and we will in the future undoubtedly make, similar mistakes on our own projects. So please view these conversations as education rather than judgment of mistakes we think we would never make. Today we're talking about Auth0's June 2018 outage, where they had a number of hours of degraded performance and some errors, and we'll get into all those details after a little bit of housekeeping. So first off, thank you to everybody that's been listening to the show. It's been great to hear from people that are enjoying it, and the only thing we would ask of you is that you go to Apple or Spotify and you give us a nice rating and review if you've liked it. That would really help us out, so thank you very much. Next, if there's any outages that you've been a part of or heard of and that there's a public write-up on, we would love for you to tell us about them so that we can dig into what you think is most important. So you can just hit us up on Twitter or leave a comment on the blog at the Downtime Project, and we will take a look at everything you send us.
And I think we also have a little news about your startup, right, Tom?
Yes, my startup is now out of stealth. I've been working on this for about 6 months, and it's amazing to finally be able to talk about it. The name of the company is Common Room, and we're building some great products to help companies work with their online communities. You can learn a little bit more about what we're doing at commonroom.io, but if your company has an online community, like a public Slack or Discourse, definitely check out the website and sign up for the waiting list. Or if you're interested in working at a rapidly growing startup with a pretty amazing team and hopefully not causing any terrible outages along the way, come find me on LinkedIn or apply on our jobs board. Also, as part of that media blitz for the launch, I was on a couple of other podcasts. One of my co-founders, Viraj, and I were on the March 31st episode of Software Engineering Daily, where we talked about a lot of the tech we're using and how we're building the product. And then we were on a two-part episode of the ELC podcast, where we talked about our history working together and how we work together at Common Room. I've worked with Viraj for about 15 years in various capacities, and so it was a ton of fun to sit down and reminisce about some of the fun stuff we've done together. So check those out. I really enjoyed recording them, and if you can't get enough listening to me, now you've got two more options.
And I'll also throw in my pitch that you all should go check out Common Room. I think what they're building over there is really cool. My own startup, which is not yet out of stealth, I can't wait until we're far enough along that we can make use of what Tom is building at his startup. So go check it out.
Awesome. Well, cool. So today we're talking about Auth0. In 2018, they had an outage, and we're going to go through it. They wrote a very solid postmortem that we'll link to in the show notes. So to start with, though, Jamie, why don't you tell us a little bit about what Auth0 does?
Yeah, cool. So Auth0 is an authentication and access control platform, a service provider. So you might say, what does this mean? Why wouldn't I, you know, just do it myself? So let's talk about what you would need to do if you try to do it yourself to modern standards. So you obviously need to have a way that users can create passwords. You need to be able to store those passwords safely. They need to be able to reset the passwords. These days, the expectation is going to be they could do OAuth type single sign-in with Google, Facebook, other third parties. You need to have some access control granularity where you can flag what kinds of resources the different accounts are entitled to based on their, you know, their level or their status or whatever. And you also need to have extra security features, right? Like things like two-factor authentication using SMS or, you know, one-time codes or YubiKeys. So there's a lot to build actually here if you want to do this to the expectation of customers today. And OAuth is a service that takes care of all that for you. So you just use them and you don't have to build all that stuff.
Yeah, don't write all that stuff yourself. Just use a service. That is a morass to get into, and it is amazing that Auth0 takes care of all that stuff for you. So definitely, if you find yourself writing your own SSO integration or something, oh God, just please use something different. So
yep.
Well, cool. So let's run through the postmortem. So reading this postmortem was very educational. We learned a lot about the problem and the response, but you can tell that it has been redacted or run through some kind of approval process a little bit, because there are some things that aren't in here that we'll sort of call out as we go. There's still everything we need, I think, is in there, but notably, they don't talk about the type of database they're using, which would have been kind of important, I think. But let's get into the details of it. So this is an interesting outage because it's not one of these things where you change something and it breaks immediately. The root cause of this actually happens first about 7 or 8 days before the real problems start. So on November 20th, 2018, they pushed some new code which caused some database migrations to run. This is very standard. As code gets deployed, a lot of times you'll have a schema migration, and that's just how it works. Normally this works fine, but in this case, two indexes failed to rebuild due to some malformed email addresses. Exactly what they say is, a deployment of new code to our US production environment resulted in the failure of two indexes to rebuild. So I don't know how that would happen. Jamie, do you have any ideas?
Yeah, this is actually, to Tom's point about the details missing, it's a little hard to understand exactly what they mean here. They mention index failures due to email addresses. I mean, most indexing systems and databases are not going to care about the semantics of the structure of an email address. So one thing they might mean is that, like, one thing Tom and I were imagining could be meant here is maybe they added a uniqueness constraint to the email index, and assuming that the emails were unique, and then you could imagine an application code or something, there might have been a bug where they were checking to see if the address was already in there before they had maybe normalized the case or before they had stripped whitespace, and then they were not getting a match. And then before they inserted the email, they were stripping whitespace or normalizing case. And then so essentially they were creating duplicate records, duplicate emails in the database. And later on, if you go try to add an index saying, yeah, make that unique, that's going to fail because it's not actually unique. So here's one example of what we could imagine happened here. But without the details, a little hard to say. But the net result is this index, which I'm sure was optimizing a whole bunch of queries for them. It sounds like it did not exist after this because the new definition could not succeed in being built that way.
Yeah, I think most indexes only get added after they're needed. And so if an index that you were expecting to be there doesn't exist, that's going to be a problem. But somehow the system powered on for about 7 more days without any problems showing up until November 27th, when they started to get a heavy increase in these malformed requests that they'll later find out were not a DOS attack. They definitely thought it was, but I think they say that it's just a customer with a misconfiguration. But for whatever reason, they start getting a bunch of these requests that are, and again, this is where it'd be awesome to have some details, but for these requests are causing a lot more load, a lot more CPU somehow. So a couple hours later, they get an alert about database replication lag, which we've talked about this before, but if you've got a primary and a secondary database, all your writes go to the primary, but all the writes also have to be streamed over to the secondary. And if the secondary gets too far behind, you start to have problems. So most people have an alert about how many seconds behind the secondary is. So that fired and triggered some engineer or SRE to take a look at it.
Yeah, this is a good example of a place where lacking the specific database details, we have to guess here a little bit at why this happened, stuff like that. We've both had some experience with MongoDB, and so one guess we sort of had early is this sounds like this may be MongoDB, which is known to have some issues with replication lag when the primary gets busy. And we did some digging online and did find other separate documents where Auth0 does say MongoDB is their primary source of truth. So that may be what happened here. Many databases will attempt to somehow keep the resources fairly separate between replicating data and taking servicing new requests from clients. MongoDB is known to have issues sometimes where if the primary gets too busy attempting to keep up with requests coming from clients, it will start to lag its replication streams to the secondary. So, and that sounds like what happened here.
And so in this case, the primary was probably very busy because it was, I'm sure, burning a ton of CPU because it didn't have the index that it wanted, but also potentially these malformed requests are also causing more load on it somehow. But for whatever reason, they're getting a lot of this lag. And so about an hour after the alert, they decide to resync the replicas. And as we talked about before, that involves copying the data from the primary back to the secondary. And that is not a free process. It's going to put some load onto the primary, which is just going to make everything a little bit worse. So around the same time, they file an incident about degraded perf. This kicks off their whole process. Their status page gets updated. And a little bit after that, they restart the application servers. That doesn't seem to work. So they add more capacity to the app servers, which I think helps a little bit, but you have to be really careful about that when your problem is database load, because that can actually just allow you to put more load on the database. If you're running out of workers on your app servers because your database is too busy, being able to put more work into your database is not going to help.
Yep.
And I think you see that in the next point in the postmortem, which is that they start seeing higher latencies in other services. So I'm guessing what happened there is they started putting enough load onto the database now that it started to spill over and affect more stuff. Does that read right to you, Jamie?
Yeah, I think that sounds exactly what happened. Their pinch was kind of in the back of this pipeline, and by fattening up the middle of the pipeline, all they did is increase the pinch at the back. And then things just get worse.
Yeah, just the congestive failure. So at this point, the request rate failure starts going up all over the place. And so they promote the status level of the incident to be major. And then this gets into a point Jamie and I were a little confused about, where they bring this secondary cluster into action. So they take all of the traffic from the primary cluster, primary application servers, and they start failing it over to a secondary cluster, which I assume is just a set of servers they have available in a different availability zone. But they do that instead of just kill-9ing everything in the primary cluster. But
right
after they do this failover, things start to look a little bit better.
Yeah, it's not completely clear how this helped. They had like an earlier note about restarting the services, so I'm sure they attempted to restart the services a few times. And so at first, it's the secondary cluster failing over to it. You would say, again, if it's still talking to the same database, why did that fix anything? But I think in the future sort of points here in the notes, it starts to become a little clearer about why they did this. And it seems as though the secondary cluster, they're able to target different deployments on these clusters, so they can start to try to figure out what's wrong with this code, basically by having the secondary cluster and the primary cluster running different versions of their software so they can isolate the problem.
Yeah. So after they get traffic over to the secondary and things look okay, they start working on bringing the primary back online. But they do that by rolling it back to a previous version. And they don't specify if it's the previous version that was running or the previous commit or what, but this is a part I was a little confused about. Bringing the primary back with the previous version doesn't work because there's a bug in it, so it doesn't come up healthy.
Yeah, this is kind of confusing, because presumably if it was the previous deployed version, that one should already be known good, right? For a definition of good that clears their production bar because it ran for a while. So it's a little confusing as to why there's a bug. I mean, one speculation could be there may be a forwards versus backwards compatibility issue where like they changed something in a way that like they can't go back in the application code.
That's a great point. They might have already written out some state that the old version can't handle.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's a classic issue right there.
So maybe it was that. Yeah. So we don't have the details. So, yeah.
So at this point, they're about 5 hours in after the first alert about the replication lag, and they begin to suspect that they maybe don't have all the indexes they need. And at this point, things start to move a little bit quicker in terms of getting to some resolution. But they take down one of the services, or the service that relies on the missing index, and start to add it back. 15 minutes later, they get that service back up. 40 minutes later, they find another endpoint that was using, the other missing index, and they can just block that endpoint at the router level, or the, load balancer level. And then a little bit later, they get the bug fix that was keeping the primary cluster down. They get traffic back to that. They then have some load balancer config issue, so they have to go back to the secondary cluster. And at that point, it seems like they kind of give up on the primary cluster for the day. They're about 7 hours in after the alert. So it's also probably, it's definitely the middle of the night by now, 8:45 UTC. which I forget what time that is, but it's late. Then a few hours after that, they finally get a suspicious IP address that the activity with that IP address lines up with everything that's happened with the incident.
This was their previously suspected denial of service attack was all coming from this IP, right?
Yep. So they block the IP address and they notify the customer. And then a minute later, metrics are all back to normal. So they got the indexes fixed. They got the IP address blocked and life is good again. And then 5 or 6 hours after that, they are able to route everything back to the primary cluster.
Yep. So it looks like there's a nice meta comment actually about this. I think that's actually 17 hours later, Tom, because I think the time is
it's a whole different day.
They probably let everybody get some sleep. Yeah, which is again the kind of cultural that like, yeah, you're running on the secondary. Yes, you probably want to fall back over to the primary, but they probably took a breather at that point and told everybody, look, go home. We'll fall back to the primary tomorrow, which is probably the right call to make there. So
yeah, that makes sense.
Okay.
So just to summarize all that, kind of some really unlucky timing here. They had two indexes, didn't rebuild when there was a code push, and it just made everything not work great. It used resources that they otherwise would have had available to deal with this problem of this mysterious anomalous traffic. So once either one of these things on their own may have been fine, but when you bring them together, you see this problem that it's always hard to isolate something when it wasn't something that just changed. And so I'm sure they didn't think about these indexes immediately because, you know, that change had gone out a week ago and everything had been fine.
Right.
But having these two together, once you added in the resyncing databases, just tipped everything over and caused the problems.
Yep.
So let's run through the things that you think went well, Jamie.
Yeah. I mean, one thing to call out of the gate is they have a good set of action items. So if you read through on the postmortem, the list of things that they're doing in response to this, they sound like a good set of things for them to dig into. So they not only have those action items, they publish those as part of their postmortem, so we all would know that they were doing these things. And so a lot of the things they enumerate in there are things that we too occurred to us as we're reading through there.
Because I mean, one of the whole goals of these postmortems is to build trust with your customers and just to let them know, look, this thing that happened was really crazy, but here are all the things we're doing to keep anything like it from happening again. And yeah, the list of action items they had, I think I agree with every single one of them, but it's just a solid list.
Yeah, I mean, I think another thing in here that was particularly well handled compared to potentially other tech companies is the communication with customers here was good. So you certainly could see a panicking team trying to restore the service, just like block that IP, the engineers to do that and to not really think about the ramifications of blocking that IP. But Tom, it doesn't sound like that's what happened here, right?
Yeah, I think it's pretty clear that they had somebody working the incident that could get in touch with the customer and tell them exactly what was going on. I think there were several cases where customers had to be contacted. And so that means they had some sort of incident process where when things start to go wrong, you get more than just engineers into the room or Slack or however they were dealing with this. You would have somebody who owns the customer relationship who is on call to either contact the customer or advise whether or not something is going to be okay. You probably had other people who, you know, could make decisions if things got really bad. But yeah, they were able to get in touch with the right people. And that should be a big part of any incident response. It's just making sure your customers know what's going on and what to expect.
Yep. You know, once the fact that they had eventually figured out where this traffic was coming from, they did have a way to filter that traffic out, right? So, going back to the engineering side of the response to this malformed traffic, that they were able to take action on that. Sounds like there was some kind of traffic layer that helped them, right?
Yeah, that's just so nice to be able to turn things off. If if you have a sufficiently complicated application, just to be able to say, stop running this, just fail it all. Sometimes you have to damage one thing to save everything else, but you have to have built that functionality beforehand.
Yep. So what else, Tom?
Let's see. I like that they had the secondary cluster of application servers. That tells you that they've thought ahead of time about the different failure modes they might run into. That I'm speculating that it was in a different availability zone, but that would make the most sense to me. And if you have a service you need to keep running, yeah, you should have it spread out across multiple availability zones, just because I don't think Amazon makes any promises that that they're always going to keep one AZ up all the time.
Yeah. And I think that if you look at the timelines here, which we can talk about in the maybe gone better section, but the fact that it took them quite a while to fall over to this other thing, I'm guessing it was there for a different purpose, as you say, Tom, right? It probably is an AZ isolation type, like physical, weather, et cetera, type availability zone, or like Amazon misconfiguration takes out the network in an AZ or whatever. So they probably had this rainy day secondary cluster, but they still had it. I mean, they used it potentially for a different unanticipated purpose here, where they were trying to isolate a software problem, but they did have it ready. And so it was a resource that they could utilize to help solve this problem.
Yep. Also, just sort of a jokey item, but Auth0 is sold, or is in the process of selling, for $6.5 billion to Okta, I think. Yeah. So even if your startup has a really bad day and everything melts down, the future may still be bright if you write a good postmortem and publish it to the internet.
That's right. Yes. This wasn't their brightest day, but things seem to have worked out okay for them. So, know, you can survive your bad days.
Yeah. Always good to keep in mind. All right. Let's talk about some of the things that could have gone a little bit better. So what do you think, Jamie?
Yeah. So, I think one thing, just because if we think through this in timeline sequence through that extended timeline, one thing early on, right, is you really shouldn't have database migrations fail silently. So there's definitely this stuff about it is difficult to figure out what's going wrong, as you said, when the problem shows up much later than the cause. But the initial thing going wrong, they did not know, right? So that seems like an issue. If there's something that you deploy, whether it's a code change or a configuration change or a database alteration or whatever, and that deployment, a piece of that deployment does not succeed, that should be something you know about when it fails.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's just so key. I mean, like I said, indexes, if you're adding them, you need them. And for it to just fail and not know about it, you're basically running in a weird, untested state at that point. And any number of things could happen. You might start getting corrupted data. I mean, just because you were expecting some unique constraint to be there, which could be a huge pain to clean up. I think one of the best case scenarios, if you don't add an index you were expecting, is that things just get slow and you can figure it out and fix it. But indexes are, they're important stuff. So that's a bad sign that it was able to fail without any alert going off.
Yeah, certainly. As you said, there could have been things that were introduced to the database layer that are constraint type situations that are protecting you from bugs or something. And if one of those had failed, yeah, it could be really sinister, right? It could take you years to figure out you've quietly corrupted some data. And then at that point, it's really hard to wind the clock back and figure out how to fix it. So you definitely want to know if this thing didn't work.
Yeah.
Another thing to call out here, right, is that database queries were allowed to take arbitrarily long amounts of time, it seems. There's, I think, some notes in their action items and stuff like that about implementing database timeouts, right, to reduce long-running queries. So that suggests that they did not have them before this. I will say with some confidence that, like, if you have a production database, you need a non empty value for the longest query you'll allow to run on that, right? So for your analytics database or maybe your secondaries or whatever, like, you know, maybe you loosen that or you don't care or whatever, or you're okay to just respond when things get bad. For your primary servicing traffic with an uptime and availability requirement, you have to define some value for the longest query that you expect to run on that system.
If you expect a query to take 10 milliseconds and it's taken 10 seconds, I mean, it might as well have failed at that point.
Yes.
Just kill it. Send the 500.
Right.
Odds are you're going to get a much better and tighter alert on that anyway, and just do it.
Yeah, or maybe even all your traffic servicing queries are totally fine, but someone doing an analytics job accidentally connected to the primary, right? And so they're running some big table scan on your system, and they didn't mean to, right? So yeah, you should have that job should just die, and they go, oh, what happened to my query? And then they'll discover eventually they're on the wrong database. So you definitely need to make sure you've capped the kind of worst case scenario load on your database in terms of a single query. In general, databases, I guess this is kind of related to a meta point, but databases are kind of my background, so I'll sort of throw this in there. Like, databases are happier with short queries, and not even like linearly happy, like super linearly happy. Like, it's much better to like try to make sure your database is doing as close to point queries as possible, or if it's going to be doing range queries that they're on an index where things are adjacent, especially if you're on spinning media, which you may or may not be depending on your deployment. But generally speaking, you want to have queries to be fairly fast on a production database. And then you want to figure out if there are things you need to do that are big scans of data, try to put those onto secondaries or on analytics databases or data warehouses or whatever. Try to find some way to move those off of your traffic servicing database where your customer's performance and availability is going to be impacted. Cool. You know, another thing to point out here, also related to the databases, is they started this when the secondaries started lagging and they were getting alerted about that. They did start the resyncing of the secondary before they completely understood what was happening or whether that would make things better or worse. Now, I certainly can understand the impulse, right? That like, oh my gosh, we need a replica, right? Because like, what if we lose this machine? We'll lose our data. So I understand that data loss type thinking where you really want to make sure you have a secondary, but if you do that too fast, probably that secondary replication is going to fail anyway because you haven't understood yet like why it broke down the first time.
It's really hard to make too many comments on this without knowing what their playbook has typically looked like. It's completely possible they hit a problem like this once a week and they just hit resync and things are fine, and that this was just the one time where that wasn't the situation. If you're resyncing your database once a week, you probably should look at what you're doing. I don't know if that's a good thing anywhere, but yeah, without knowing how much they've had to do this for other reasons, it's hard to say whether they really should have dug into it more. But it also sounds like were they resyncing multiple databases at once?
Yeah, it's a little hard to tell from the language, but it sounds like they might have been. So, yeah,
that may not be something you want to do unless you've done that before.
Yeah. I mean, I guess maybe kind of the last point I would say on this whole database specific kind of side of things is that, I mean, their CPU's usage had to go way up when this index went away, right? Even in advance of this incident. So I think there's like maybe two different thoughts here, right? Like, one is a broad thought, which is realistically across all your machines, you should just have CPU usage monitoring, right? And so because if it goes wrong anywhere, I mean, if it goes wrong at the application layer, maybe you have a bug in your code that made some, I mean, we just talked about Cloudflare recently where they had something get really expensive in their filtering. If something goes wrong in your application layer and your CPU usage changes dramatically, you should probably know about it and know that that's what you meant and that that's not a problem. But certainly at your database layer as well, if the CPU usage spikes, you should know about it for sure. But the other thing I would just say about databases, right, and this gets back to, we talked a little bit about like measuring the thing you mean in a previous episode, I think when we were talking about like restorations and is that what you should alert on or should you alert on backups, right? But like the definition of what a database does, right, is it services requests? People send queries and it gives it responses to those queries. And so let's say we only had CPU monitoring on the database, right? And let's say that what happened is the disks filled up. And if you, a lot of file systems, as they approach 90-95% plus capacity, they start to run into some breakdowns, right? So the performance starts to get significantly worse as you get close to disk saturation. So what may actually happen, right, is the database slows down, not because of CPU usage, it slows down because the IO subsystem is taking longer to fetch records off the disk or something like that. So it's another instance where, like, for a database, you should definitely have monitoring around your query response times, right? Because at the end of the day, whatever the reason, and you want to monitor those other things too, right? The sort of causal things, but like whatever the reason, if your database starts slowing down, that's the problem, right? So, and that way you have a pretty broad coverage of like the definition of what this service is and the definition of when it starts to be no longer sufficiently providing that service, right? And for a database, a safe way to characterize that is the request, you know, the request success rate and the request sort of P50, P75, P99, whatever different cuts you want to take of the response time. And if that starts to get way worse, you should go look into that, because like that probably means something went wrong.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, alerts like this can be hard to tune because you might have traffic that comes and goes, but it's, yeah, I would be really curious to know what their alerting story on CPU and query time was like before this incident. I'm sure it's way, way better now. But, and not just alerting on it, though, you really want to be able to visualize this sort of thing.
That too, so, for sure.
Because if you imagine this graph, I mean, I'm imagining it, there was a pretty clear stair step.
Yes. Yeah.
There was before the push went out that messed up the indexes and after. And anyone, I mean, it doesn't require any experience as an engineer to look at that and say, something changed.
Right.
You know, that looks problematic. And then go, oh, look, this lined up with a push. Yeah, if you're in a really good state, you can have your graphs overlaid with other events like pushes or deploys, things like that. But yeah, it and even one step beyond that is being able to have graphs of where particular requests are spending their time,
mm-hmm.
and being able to see, you know, this request used to take 1 second and spend, you know, 100 milliseconds querying the databases. And now on a graph, you see, oh, now the request is taking 3 seconds and it's spending 2.1 seconds waiting on the database. Like that, clearly what regressed is the database. The other thing looks fine.
Yeah, this is, tracing type capabilities and stuff. Those things are great. Yeah, I think that the database getting slower, that whole thing about the stair step, just because sometimes like what's fun to talk about is like the advanced versions of these things too. Like, again, like probably doesn't apply to most companies, but is useful to think about as like something amazing that like huge companies will do if they have the resource to invest in it. So, one of the things that's interesting, right, is every time you make a change, right, to your production environment, there's a whole bunch of lines that move a little bit, right, in response to that. And as the bigger your company gets, it gets to the point where there's so many lines that like, it's hard to check all of them, right? And similarly, it's hard to anticipate all the like threshold setting you should do and alerting you should set up for all of those lines, right? Like maybe a lot of them might be, you know, derivative and everything, so like you don't need to monitor those too. But one thing that's kind of cool that is an advanced thing that I know a lot of companies are looking at and probably some of the biggest companies have implemented versions of is automated anomaly detection, right? So like systems that look for trend breaks, and especially if they can do it in canary type deployments, and then as part of the deployment process, like a release manager or something sees a summary of like these lines went up an odd amount, right? And that person has to actually approve those changes. Like, we knew that was going to get slower. That's what we meant, right?
Yep.
So there's definitely some versions of this. Again, if you're getting into the like gold standard of things that are awesome when it comes to these lines, you always want a human to be able to see them, right? But there also arrives a day where there's too many lines for a human to like to look at all of them. And you can start to get into things where you can start to automate some of that and have systems look for anomalous changes, right, across all of these things.
Yeah, that actually ties in really well with another point I wanted to make. Is it sounded like they didn't have any great systems here for identifying anomalies in their traffic.
Yep.
They weren't really able to cut everything up by customer, by IP address, or by remote IP address and sort of see what's, for the requests that are slow, what's weird about them. Mm-hmm. So there are tools now that claim to make this a lot easier than it used to be. I've sort of been evaluating this tool called Honeycomb. We haven't put everything on it yet, but I've been going through some of the demos and taking a look at it. And it has a really fascinating approach where it shows you can look at all of your events in the system in sort of a heat map mm-hmm. format, where you get time on the x-axis and like latency on the y-axis. And then you can actually just drag a box around outliers. Like there's a set of events that are a lot slower than everything else, and they're kind of standing out as a dot up above. You can just select those, and then it will show you what is most statistically distinct about those requests. Mm. And attached to each event, I guess they use the term event, not request, but attached to each event, you have things like, what is the code version it's running? What is the IP address it's coming from? What is the customer ID? What is the route? What is whatever you want to, whatever might cause a different pattern in your traffic? And so then once you select these anomalies, it will actually show you what's interesting about these, like which of these event attributes they all share, or most of them share, compared to all the other traffic around the same time. Mm. And so with something like that, it would be pretty easy just to see, oh, look, all these things seem to be coming from the same IP address. And that would, I think, have potentially taken hours out of this investigation, because ultimately one of the big sources of their load was anomalous requests from one customer and one IP address.
Yeah, the tools like that are amazingly powerful for sure, especially for the like human guided parts of the thing, where a visualization like that is sometimes just the most direct way to discover, like, oh, hey, there's this, like, most things are over here in this cloud, in the point cloud. And then there's these funky ones that are a separate little, it's usually a modal thing, right? It's like there's a bimodal thing where it's like, then there's all of these over in this other weird cloud. Like the fact that the tool, the Honeycomb you just described, has a capability to sort of just drag a box around those and say, show me attributes about those and show me like places those attributes are unique, like highlight that. That's amazing. So that's pretty cool.
Because a lot of times with these perf variations, there's not anything really magic happening. It's like, it's the customer who has the 500 megabyte file. You know, it's the team that has, you know, 20 times more whatevers than other people.
Right.
You always have these outliers, and being able to see where they stand out is, you have a lot of neurons associated with your visual cortex.
That's true, yeah.
Being able to pull those into these problems is really helpful.
And if there was a way to describe the ones that are more interesting, maybe versus not interesting, like things which look like they're just following a standard distribution are probably just like physics, right? So like you're going to have a tail if it looks like a standard normal tail, right? Things that are modal are usually where things are interesting, right? Like you have your normal tail and then you have a cluster at the end of the tail. Like that's weird, right? Like that probably means that something funky is happening. Those are interesting. So, and your eye is able to tell that obviously really quickly, right? It's not just a tapering off of the tail. It's like, there's this extra mode that's clustered at the tail, right? And like, what the hell is that?
Yeah. And if you'll always learn something if you investigate a bimodal distribution, like there's always something that's causing that.
Right.
It's not natural. It's some timeout or some cap or something like that. But yeah.
Yep. Cool. Well, let's see. What else do you have, Tom?
I think we had to point out that this was pretty unlucky just to have all this stuff happen. And there's absolutely a world where even though that migration failed silently, somebody looked at the site and said, oh, this feels slower. And they went and looked at it and, oh, look, why are we burning all the CPU? And they fixed that index issue an hour after it goes out versus having both these things happen at the same time. They also didn't catch a great break on the timing of it. I think this thing really started running about 8 p.m. Pacific and didn't really wrap up till about 4 a.m. And man, it just sucks. 2 a.m. to be unsure of what's going on, worried about breaking stuff, and everybody's tired. It's just not fun.
Yeah, I I think related to that, like one thing I would point out, and this is, these are always fun to talk about, right? Because it's more about the meta layer. It's about the corporate layer. It's about the culture layer and stuff like that. This timeline is really long, right? It's actually one of the things we have to point out, right? So it's, you know, 8 hours, and there were a lot of movements during those 8 hours. And realistically, your company needs to be able to move through something like this faster than this. So, and the reason is just not because how I feel about it, right? It's because there's a way that people box in their head how bad it is when something happens, right? So like bad things happen to systems all the time, right? You have an exception log. I guarantee you it's not empty. So is mine, right? So, but the truth is that like, bad things happening for 10 seconds, there's not even a conversation with the customer because people sort of shrug their shoulders and they refresh the browser and the world goes on. Bad things happening for 5 minutes is different. Bad things happening for, you know, 2 hours are different. Again, those things are kind of modal, right? It's like, oh, that kind of sucked versus like, well, I didn't get anything done this morning versus should I still use this company, right? And so when you start getting into the 8+ hour range, those incidents are in the about as serious as it gets, right? Because you're talking like if that had landed on a different part of the day, and I'm sure they're a global company, so it is in the meat of the day for a lot of international customers, like that's a work day that they were out, right? The whole day they didn't have service, right? And so, you know, this is, there's obviously a million small cuts that get you there, and like it's an easier thing to say than it is to like create a simple prescription for like how you don't do it. But you definitely need to have conversations around afterward the overall timeline here, right? And as an operational culture, why did it take us so long to move through all these things? And are there meta issues around how much we've invested in this or whatever, or that like are not just about a single thing we should change, but just like, you know, maybe even our confidence as an operational team, right? Because we don't know, we weren't in the room. We don't know what happened, right? But like each one of these steps took quite a while to move through. And so you do need to acknowledge that like you have to be able to operate a little tighter than that. And they're not even just technical issues. Sometimes they might just be like process issues or personnel issues, or were the right people in the room, or were people being indecisive because they didn't know if they had authority to make decisions, right? And all that kind of stuff. Because 8 hours is in that category of a fairly serious incident to their company's reputation, right?
Now, the nice thing is that it doesn't sound like they were totally down a big chunk of this time. Like they don't actually say what any of the error rates were. There weren't any graphs. And so it's totally possible that 98% of these requests were succeeding and they just consider a 2% error rate for 8 hours to be a big outage. So
that's
this sounds like the kind of thing where if you retry a few times, it's probably, or it might work. But yeah, I definitely agree that the length of time can almost be, or it's just such a huge factor in this, because even if things are very bad for a small amount of time, they're just not going to affect that many people.
Sure.
Whereas moderately bad for a longer time, you're just statistically, you're going to hit a lot more of your customers.
Yeah. Not only that, a lot of it is also about the PR, right? Like, so if you have small error rates, you might get some engineers talking to each other, a few people tweeting about it, like you go on for a short amount of time. If you're out for a couple hours and you're a reasonably large profile internet service, now the press might talk about it a little bit. If you're out for a day, right, you're going to start to have CEOs of other companies reach out to you and say, I'm not sure I should still be a customer of yours, right? So there's also like these kind of...
Let's talk about our SLA agreement.
Right. There's also this raising awareness of who, you know, how much is this something everyone is talking about versus... but yeah, you're right. We actually don't know how serious this was. I will say that the piece I look at it more than that and is when I read this postmortem, I see steps I recognize in there, right? I've been on teams that have walked through those same kinds of steps, right?
Yep.
And these, in this instance, the steps were reasonable, but I would say the timelines were quite a bit longer than normally operational teams try these things, right? And so there's something worth examining about, and now this is, again, in the rearview mirror, this is 3 years ago, Auth0 has been acquired, but like, so for any given company, I think it's also worth saying, are we happy with our time to resolve here? And like, are there reasons that are more than just a specific technical problem that are causing us to move too slowly or too cautiously through these debugging phases.
Yeah. And the last thing I would say is, and it definitely tied in with that, is do some DRTs. They don't mention these at all in the postmortem, but they had some kind of weird issue with a load balancer configuration error when they were switching back and forth between primary and secondary, which is exactly the kind of thing that a DRT is there to shake out. That problems like that happen, it's much better for them to happen when everybody is looking at all the graphs and everybody is caffeinated and awake, and you've potentially already notified your customers that this is a maintenance window or something like that. But having some practice, you know, failing back and forth between these is going to speed everything up, because I'm guessing they don't do that a lot.
Yeah.
I'm guessing that there was a lot of discussion about whether or not we should do it. Is this worth it? How do we do it? Oh, can you get so-and-so online? They were the last person to do it. Things like that.
Yep. I agree completely. Yeah. Makes sense. DRTs are, they've come up in previous episodes and it feel like they would have helped here as well.
Yep. All right. So I think that's about it for today. So again, if you like the show, please go leave us a review and a rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcast. We'd really appreciate it. Also, if you want to follow us, we're at SevReview on Twitter. And that's all for today. Thank you very much, folks.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to The Downtime Project. You can subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you'd like to read a transcript of the show or leave a comment, visit us at downtimeproject.com. You can follow us on Twitter at SevReview. And if you like the show, we'd appreciate a 5-star review.